It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The last time America was this divided was during the Civil War. Many of us struggle to understand how we got to this point. New research into how our political behaviors are shaped by our worldview may give us some insight into how we got where we are today in America and much of the rest of the world. Do you drive a pickup or a Prius? If you bought coffee on your way to work this morning, was it Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks? Do you prefer cats or dogs, burger and fries or sushi? Or do you think someone could guess your political party based on how you answered those questions? And why do you think our country is so divided these days? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mark Hetherington is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also an award-winning author. His latest book is called Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me today.
And Jonathan Weiler co-authored Prius or Pickup. He's a professor in global studies at UNC Chapel Hill, where he directs undergraduate studies. He's also written several books. Jonathan, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, first we have to ask, starting with Mark, cat or dog?
It's really complicated, I got to tell you. But I would be on the cat side, I think, as far as worldview is concerned, but I actually have a small dog who looks like a cat.
So a dog and a small dog who looks like a cat. Well, that's interesting. Jonathan, how about you, cat or dog?
I love dogs, but I, in fact, am exclusively a cat owner.
So what do these answers say about the two of you, do you think?
Well, the interesting thing about these kind of strange tastes that we've identified that Americans have about things that don't seem to be political at all is that they tend to map onto our politics. And even if they don't map exactly onto our politics, like, you know, I have a dog and Jonathan has a cat, what's happened is Americans now see the other side of the political divide as these kind of caricatures of people who aren't like them. You know, so if you're from a more traditional area, you look at the other side as being full of people who eat sushi, like cats, and drive Priuses. And if you're in one of those more cosmopolitan areas, you see the world in exactly the opposite way. And the big problem that we have with this situation is that, you know, it causes us to almost discriminate against people by their party even before we get to know them, even before we meet them, even before we really understand who they are as people.
America has never been more politically polarized than it is right now, at least not since the Civil War. But many of us can remember a time when political differences were more about matters of policy than matters of belief. Mark, when did that change and why?
Well, this has been a process that's been taking off, has been happening over the course of the last 50 or so years. You know, so, you know, you point out something that's really, really different, that's really, really important, and this is key to our story, that there, you know, in the era after the New Deal in the 1930s, there were really serious differences between Republicans and Democrats, but they tend to be programmatic. They tended to be about things like the free enterprise system and business versus labor and whether government ought to be more or less involved in different things. And, you know, the interesting thing about those things is, of course, there were disagreements, but they're kind of complicated for ordinary people to understand. And on most of those things, there are places where we could compromise. You know, you could say more government, less government. Well, we can meet in between about those things. But starting in the 1960s with the emergence of the civil rights movement and then the women's rights movement and then later sexual orientation movement, LGBT movement, immigration, terrorism, we ended up changing what divided Republicans from Democrats, from these complicated issues about how big government ought to be to these very easy symbolic issues where it's very difficult for people to compromise about them, race, gender, sexual orientation, immigration, things along those lines. So this has been a process that has been going on since the 1960s and has reached a crescendo in this particular moment in time. And it's manifested as this, boy, era where people on opposite sides of the political divide have never disliked each other as much as they dislike each other now.
Jonathan, help us kind of get a better understanding here, because what Mark is describing pretty much, you know, I mean, that seems pretty accurate in terms of where we are today with how we feel. But did this start, did this come from the bottom up, or was there something else going on here in terms of decisions made by political leaders to begin to try to align worldview and political leanings?
It's a great question, John. The role of leaders in our story is critical, and it's critical both historically and critical today. So in the 1960s, to take a step back in time for a moment, when advisors around Richard Nixon were trying to figure out how to help him get elected, you know, in 1968, advisors like a young Pat Buchanan, for example, you know, they weren't asking themselves, how can we appeal to, you know, folks that we describe as fixed voters? All they wanted to ask themselves was, how can we win this election? And in order to do that, they needed to break the vice grip of the New Deal coalition on American politics. And they, among other things, settled on what many people refer to as the Southern Strategy, these appeals on issues like law and order and race, to try to shear off what we used to call blue-collar ethnic voters, what we now call white working-class voters, from the New Deal coalition. And so they really were just trying to reconfigure the political map because it had been so unfavorable to them. What they did, though, was they set in motion a process whereby over the next several decades, on issue after issue, Democrats and Republicans increasingly tended to fashion their appeals in ways that happened to be attractive to folks on different sides of the worldview divide. And what that engendered over time were bases in the two parties that were themselves much more clearly anchored in worldview and therefore much more likely to demand of their leaders a kind of purity on worldview, so that this really becomes a reinforcing cycle that begins with elites, political elites, but then becomes really a shared worldview from top to bottom in each party.
Mark Hetherington is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jonathan Weiler is professor of global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. They stay with us to continue to discuss the book that they co-wrote titled Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. What would you like to know about the idea that seemingly insignificant choices can reveal your deep feelings? Do you think it makes sense, or are you skeptical? Do you defy the odds? Maybe you're a pickup-driving, burger-and-fries-eating person who supports open borders, or perhaps you drive a hybrid and order cuisine from all over the world, who think immigration is a threat to America. How do you see yourself? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our conversation continues in a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Mark Hetherington is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Jonathan Weiler is professor in global studies at UNC at Chapel Hill. They've written a book titled Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. What would you like to know about the idea that seemingly insignificant choices you make in your life can reveal your deep political feelings? You think that makes sense? Are you skeptical? Share your ideas with us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Mark, what are the four questions that are referred to in the title of your book?
Well, they're questions of all things about desirable qualities in children. And the question is, the four questions are prefaced in this way. And I think it's a really interesting way for us to get at, you know, what people's fundamental views of the world are. So it starts like this. Although there are a number of qualities in children that people feel, that children should have, every person thinks that some are more important than others. And then what happens is we read the people different pairs and ask them to choose between one or the other. And the thing is, we want kids to have all of these things, but if we had to choose, which ones would you choose? And the pairs are this: independence on the one hand, or respect for elders on the other, curiosity versus good manners, obedience versus self-reliance, and being considerate versus being well-behaved. And what the Democratic Coalition has come to be characterized by are people who favor children who are independent, curious, self-reliant, and being considerate kids. And on the Republican side, overwhelmingly, people choose the answers respect for elders, good manners, obedience, and being well-behaved. And it's not to say that any of those eight characteristics are better or worse than the others. It's that those characteristics reveal the way people understand the world, whether it's a world that is safe to explore, let your kids be independent and curious, or if it's a more dangerous place that you need to kind of hunker down against, where you need sort of obedient kids with good manners who are respectful. So on the one hand, you have these sort of tradition-based, you know, sort of older understanding of what makes a good child versus a more modernist understanding of what makes a good child. And what those answers do is they tell us people's beliefs about an incredible array of things in politics. On the one hand, their racial attitudes, their attitudes about immigration, and so forth. But they also tell us their attitudes about all sorts of other things, like their preferences in coffee and beer and cars and all sorts of other things that people actually really care about.
Jonathan, none of these things seem inherently political. Why are these seemingly shallow questions so revealing?
Yeah, it's. I think one reason is to focus on these four parenting items for a moment. I think what the four parenting items really get at, in a way that is, doesn't provoke people to think ideologically, and therefore perhaps counterintuitively makes them more revealing, is that they really just speak to people's understanding of order and hierarchy, and whether we really need folks to, especially our children, to kind of follow the straight and narrow, or whether we can give them room to roam. So it really speaks in just a very fundamental way to their sense of the nature of the world in which we live. And again, because they're not asking people about their political preferences or ideological labels or anything like that, they actually tell us more about the kinds of people we are, which then allows us to, I think, draw some very interesting connections to our political views and our political and our ideological leanings and those kinds of things.
As we expected, we have a lot of people who want to join us by phone this morning. Let's start with Pete in Green Bay. Pete, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, everyone. I'm just amazed at how science and let's take an issue like climate change has become so politicized. I never believed that science would be so intertwined in politics. Because based on how you discuss that or ask that question, I believe you could make a pretty good determination on someone's political leanings.
Pete, thanks for that. Mark, on that issue being polarized, if you asked Americans those same four questions about qualities in kids a few decades ago, or questions about science, would the answers have been as revealing?
Well, the interesting thing is that there's nothing necessarily inherent about climate change that ought to be connected to the answers to those four questions. But the interesting thing about that particular issue is that because Republicans over the course of the last 20 years have taken such a clear position on this issue, to sort of doubt climate change is occurring. Of course, we've seen this recently in the news with the president just absolutely dismissing it. You know, it turns out climate is a very, very complicated issue for most people. And as a result, what people seem to be willing to do, because they're so tied to their camps now, because their worldviews are tied up in their party identification, so they need to protect their beliefs about everything, including, you know, their beliefs about the climate. So they end up taking positions on this issue that mirror what their political elites, their political leaders, their party leaders have been telling them is the truth about things. One of the things that's really interesting about that issue specifically is if you go to Europe, and what we find is these four questions are, you know, very revealing of people's voting behavior as it relates to these right-wing populist candidates in Europe, too. But nobody in Europe, really, none of the political parties there are taking positions on the climate that really are dubious about whether climate change is occurring. So there isn't that same divide there that we have in the United States. The reason that we have the divide that we have in the United States is because Republican politicians have taken the position that it's just not happening. And the people in the electorate who follow the Republicans think, well, it must not be happening because these are the leaders that I believe in.
Jonathan, your book more or less divides the population into two groups, fixed and fluid. Please explain these terms in the context of your research.
Yeah, so the folks who we describe as fixed are on the conservative end of the spectrum. And we use that term to describe a worldview where, as we've alluded to already, people want to sort of stick with what's familiar, what's tried and true, whereas folks on the other side of the spectrum who are associated with liberalism in the United States, the folks that we call the fluid, are more attracted to the novel and the new. And so these are basic orientations to the world in which we live, to ideas about change, and to ideas about just diversity and difference, the kinds of things that we're spending so much time in acrimonious disagreement about.
And what about the idea that there was a tradition in America that we respected expertise, we respected learning, and those who had done investigating and had developed science and things like that? That is a tradition, but it is under fire. It has been for a number of decades. Where does that fit into this fixed and fluid continuum?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it goes back to Pete's question just about science having become politicized. And in that way, I think just to sort of follow up on Mark's point a moment ago, this is an area where the United States really is an outlier, because for, I think, political and partisan and ideological and perhaps for business reasons, one political party has now taken a position on science, at least on some aspects of science, that is quite hostile to the enterprise. And because we're so divided in such visceral terms, it is now possible for millions of Americans to sort of go along with or share that worldview. And I just want to add one thing, John, which is that it's an interesting finding, which we've seen recur, which is that better educated conservatives are more likely to profess the skepticism about science and climate change than are less well-educated conservatives, which suggests that it's not a sort of lack of knowledge, or inability to grasp the concepts, but something else that's driving that that sense of reality.
Mark Hetherington is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jonathan Weiler is a professor of global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. They've co-written a book titled Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. We're going to continue our conversation with them and with you in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can do so at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. One idea that I think most of us would agree on is that in our lifetime, we've never seen our country so divided. This morning, we're asking how we got to this point and what we can do about it. Mark Hetherington is a political science professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Jonathan Weiler is a professor in global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. They've co-written a book titled Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. What would you like to know about the idea that seemingly insignificant choices can reveal your deep political feelings? And do you think it makes sense, or are you skeptical? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mark, we talk about fixed and fluid. It's a spectrum. Are most people fixed or fluid, somewhere in between? How does this spectrum work?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, so we can use the answers to these four questions to create a continuum where if people provide, you know, zero fixed answers to the four questions, they're at one end of the spectrum, and people who give four fixed answers to the question, they're at the opposite end of the spectrum. And then people who give two of each, you know, are right in the middle. And the most common combination is two of each, right in the middle. But that doesn't mean that most people are there. In fact, most people are to one side or the other. With about 15% of people in the most fluid, about 20% of people in the most fixed, about 25% of people in the dead middle, but more people to the fixed side of the midpoint, the center of the distribution, than others. And you know, this is something that I think, you know, the fact that the public, and it makes sense, you know, that, you know, to some degree, everybody wants a little bit of order and traditions that provide that order. And, you know, for the political party, the Republicans in this case, that promise that kind of thing, especially during chaotic times where there's a lot of change taking place, there are certain advantages to being on the side of, you know, the sameness, the way things have traditionally been done. So this is something that our research has revealed. And this goes back to something that Jonathan said earlier about the 1960s. Republicans were always losing elections from the 1930s to the 1960s. They needed to come up with a new way of dividing Americans up that was more advantageous to them. And, you know, it's by making issues like race and sexual orientation and feminism and things like that important dividing lines between the parties, they were able to accomplish that because, you know, whether it's here or whether it's in Europe or whether it's in South America, there are more people on the fixed end of the spectrum.
But what about the fact that there's been a real evolution in public opinion on some of these ideas, which would seem to be more traditional? For example, gay marriage. If you had taken a survey in 1980 about gay marriage, most Americans would have opposed it. Now, most Americans support it. And the same thing would be true with things like the legalization of marijuana, for example. How does that fit with what you found in your research?
Well, this is a really important thing to keep in mind as we think about these new issues coming on the scene. So let's take an issue like gay marriage or, you know, gay rights more generally. people have become more accepting of these institutions, of certain groups, and that's an extraordinarily important development. The lives of when you take into account the same thing happening over years on civil rights and women's rights and now gay rights, these are important developments. But the thing that happens when these issues become central to our political divide is that there's a backlash against these types of things as well. So, you know, you introduce new ideas like, say, gay rights. It hasn't been on the political agenda really before the 1980s, 1990s. And fluid people think, okay, that sounds good. We're on board with this challenge to traditions. You know, we're more open to those types of changes. But the people who are more fixed are going to push back hard against those things. And what's happened with gay rights is a remarkable evolution. We've never really seen anything happen quite like this, where opinions change so quickly on it. And I think it's important to remember that not just worldview determines people's opinions on these types of things. What makes gay rights, I think, such a much different issue from most of the other rights issues is that people have a different personal experience with gay rights than they might with other rights type issues. And I think a key difference is that people get to know other individuals as something other than gay or lesbian before they might know that they're gay or lesbian. And then once they realize that the person is, then they're not going to necessarily discriminate against them because of that. That's different from, you know, say, a racial group, where you often come to know somebody who's part of a racial group before you get to know them as a person. And I think this is one of the things that's allowed opinions, these sort of personal contacts that people have with people who are from the LGBT community, that's allowed opinion to evolve so quickly. Now, the people who have fluid worldviews, they were always basically okay with these types of things. But even people with more mixed or fixed worldviews, if they have experience with people who are different in certain ways before they know of these differences, they're going to be more accepting.
Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler are co-authors of the book Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Jonathan, let's apply the concept of fixed and fluid worldviews to some other issues. Data show that African-Americans have higher rates of poverty than white people. How do different sides view that issue?
So one of the measures that political scientists used to look at attitudes toward African Americans is something called the racial resentment scale. There's some controversy about that term and that scale, but basically what they're asking is, do you think African Americans' higher rates of poverty, lower educational rates, the fact that they're more likely to be incarcerated, is that because of structural forces, larger forces in society that make life more difficult for black Americans, or is it their own responsibility? Is it because of their own attitudes and behaviors and actions that leaves them in a disadvantaged position? And the results are very clear that folks who are fluid are far more likely, for example, to say that the reason that black Americans are disadvantaged in the ways they are is because of these larger structural factors, institutional racism, and that folks on the fixed side of the spectrum are much more likely to say that it's due to their own behaviors and it's their responsibility. And John, if I could just add one thing, just to connect this back to your question a moment ago about folks in the middle of the spectrum. You know, folks in the middle really they don't share either the fluid perspective or the fixed perspective. They're really in the middle. But on things like racial attitudes, their attitudes are closer to those of the fixed than they are to the fluid. And in this regard, fluids are are an outlier, in a sense, on some of these basic questions. Gay rights is the one issue where the mixed, the folks in the middle, are closer in their views to the fluid than they are to the fixed. And I think that's one reason why that issue has moved so far and so fast in terms of public policy in the United States over the last several years.
Let's take another issue. In the past week, Americans have used tear gas against people at the southern border. There's talk about funding a border wall in the lame duck session of Congress. Jonathan, how do people with different worldviews look at immigrants differently?
Well, you know, this is one of the areas where worldview sort of reveals one of the starkest divides between Americans, because, again, fluid Americans are much more likely to want to embrace immigrants and to argue that we should welcome them, and the fixed feel very differently. We tell a story at the beginning of the book about a poem that the president is very fond of reading to his crowds when he's at rallies. He did this during the campaign, and he still does. And it's a poem called The Snake, about a snake who cries out in distress, and the woman takes the snake in and nurtures him back to health. And for her trouble, the snake bites her and kills her. And as she's dying, she says to the snake, "Why did you do this to me?" And the snake responds, "Shut up, silly woman. You knew well who I was when you took me in." And Trump uses that to say we cannot trust outsiders. We cannot trust strangers. They might stab us in the back for our trouble. And that's a narrative that resonates very well with folks on the fixed end of the spectrum, whereas folks on the fluid end of the spectrum, as we say in the book, regard a poem like that and the attitudes it reveals as a disgusting incitement to prejudice. So it's a really stark illustration of the kind of worldview divide that we're talking about.
Jonathan Weiler and Mark Hetherington are the co-authors of the book Prius or Pickup: How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Our conversation with Jonathan and Mark continues in just a moment. But you've been listening to this for the past 45 minutes. I'm wondering what you think of all of this and where it could take us if we can't figure out a way past these different worldviews. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned that we've reached the point where we just can't get back to what we had? 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. America is a divided nation, much more so now than any of us can remember. We've been talking about why that is with the authors of the book Prius or Pickup: How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. And we have the co-authors of that book with us. They're both professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mark Hetherington is a political science professor. Jonathan Weiler is a professor of global studies. Listeners, what does it say to you that we can no longer agree on what's true or false based on our worldview? And what do you think can be done to heal the rifts in our society and get back to working together to solve common problems? 800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Barry in Rice Lake. Barry, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. My comment and then kind of a follow-up was, I think the biggest problem with the divide, and it came up with immigration just a second ago, is that they've changed the definitions of words. There used to be legal and illegal immigration. Now it's just migrants or immigration. So that's where the animosity, I think, comes from, is that we're not using the same terms, where one view says it's absolute and the other one says, well, there's a difference, but you're not allowed to discuss the definition anymore. It's just, are you or aren't you?
Barry, thanks for that call. Mark, what about words? Do we label ourselves properly party-wise or with ideology like conservative or a liberal or where we stand on immigration?
Well, this is a really interesting thing to try to develop here because language is so important in helping us understand, our reactions to things, how we frame an issue like immigration. On many of these types of issues, I think the caller is exactly right. I'll use a different example from immigration and then come back to it. But take an issue like abortion. It turns out that if you actually ask people their specific opinions about the various limitations or whatever about abortion rights, that actually the pro-life side and the pro-choice side are actually pretty close together in terms of the number of limitations or opportunities to have abortion available. They're not very far apart when you look at the specifics. But instead of looking at the specifics, what we tend to do is look at the labels. And pro-choice and pro-life seem like, completely opposite things. But here's the problem. Political leaders aren't going to provide us that kind of nuanced understanding of the fine distinctions between things. They are going to use those types of terms, that are the most polarizing ones because they know that it attracts the most resolute supporters, the most enthusiastic supporters to their side. So, with that in mind, they're going to use the types of terms as it relates to immigration or abortion or race or any of these types of things in order to attract supporters. And of course, this is going to create the kind of polarization that we have, real problems with. And let me just add one piece. We're talking about these lines of division, and in the preamble that you just provided, one of the things that I'm really concerned about is one of the consequences of this, and that is what happens to the truth under circumstances like this. If we dislike our opponents so much, we're willing to believe anything bad about them, and then we're willing to protect pretty much anything that is positive about our side. In circumstances like that, where people are so angry about the other political side that we're willing to reason about politics with such extreme bias that, we're willing to believe anything, that strikes me as a place where democracy has real problems. And I think that we're running up against that right now in the United States.
We're talking with Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler, co-authors of the book Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Let's take another phone call. Jeff joins us from Green Bay. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I haven't got to listen to the entire morning show here, but I did listen long enough to hear that it was the Republicans that introduced the sexism and the racism. And I heard about Donald Trump's disgusting poem that he likes. But I haven't heard anything. We didn't get here simply because of the Republican Party. Now, I haven't heard anything about the contributions to this issue from the Democrat Party because they're just as complicit. They're just as bad. And also, I haven't really heard anything about the mainstream media and their bias and the way that they fan the flames to all this. And simply making it worse.
Jeff, thanks for raising that question. Jonathan, do you want to respond to Jeff?
Yeah, so it's absolutely the case that in order for this kind of polarization to unfold the way it has, it takes two to tango. The story we told about how all this got underway does start back in the 1960s, and I think it does particularly start with Republican elites making certain choices, but it doesn't end there at all. The Democratic Party absolutely, over the last half a century, has staked its claim very clearly on the opposite side of these issues, especially, as Mark put it earlier, these very potent symbolic issues about gay rights, about the role of women in society, about choice, about immigration. So there's no question that it's both sides are staking they're very different claims. And I do want to clarify that poem that I mentioned. What I tried to make clear is that one side sees it as a disgusting incitement to prejudice, but that's only one side's view. The other side sees it as we say in the book, a clarion call to common sense. And so it's very much the differences between the two sides as they look at the same reality that explains why we're so powerfully divided.
Mark, where do we go from here? What's the way forward? I mean, you've identified what seems like an existential threat to democracy. Okay, so we want to survive this. I think we do. How do we go forward from here?
Well, I'll tell you this, John. I'm really discouraged and concerned about this particular moment in time. You know, one of the things that your last caller, mentioned was this notion that it's not the Republicans' fault, it's the mainstream media's fault. And, you know, this is a common thread that we hear from people when we give the talk on our book, no matter where in the country we are. But, you know, what I think that represents actually is a desire on the part of most people in this very polarized time to hear what they want to hear, to continue to believe what they want to believe, that my side, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, always wears the white hat, and the other side always wears the black hat. And under circumstances along those lines, the truth really gets lost. And, you know, we're facing this watershed moment right now where, you know, it seems quite likely, quite possible that Robert Mueller is going to introduce some pretty serious charges of malfeasance against the Trump campaign and potential collusion with the Russians and so forth. This is a remarkable moment in history when you think about what that possibility is. You know, presidential campaign being involved with a hostile foreign power. So that's a big deal if something like that happened. What are people's potential responses to this going to be if the president says it's fake news? You know, this is because of a Justice Department run amok. Republicans really want to believe that's true because they dislike Democrats so much and they've cast their lot with Donald Trump. They need to protect that worldview that they have. And, you know, the facts may well run hard against that. There aren't a lot of incentives for Republicans in Congress to say, oh, well, we ought to probably break with the president right now, because members of Congress realize that Trump's voters are also their voters. So if they attack the president, they're going to pay a price for this. Mm-hmm. So how we escape this particular moment in time is incredibly fraught. And I'm not exactly sure how we do go forward in circumstances like this.
And we'll have to remain unsure because we're out of time. Mark Hetherington, Jonathan Weiler, thanks so much for joining me this morning, and thank you for your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson.